Good afternoon. Welcome to Line One, your health connection from Alaska Public Media in Anchorage, Alaska. I'm your co-host, Dr. Thad Woodard. If you stop and think about it, mosquitoes are estimated to transmit various diseases and to about 700 million people each year worldwide. And the statistics I find is that somewhere over a million people worldwide are dying of these diseases. This makes mosquitoes the deadliest animal in the world, if those statistics are correct. So on this program, we thought we would discuss those illnesses and mosquitoes. I've asked Anchorage infectious disease specialist Dr. Ben Wesley to do that for us. He's been up here, I think, since when? 2011. He's lived in a lot of countries where he's had to address illnesses and protect himself from these illnesses, as well as see people back here in the United States. There are a number of these illnesses. It is unlikely we will cover them all. The idea is we ought to probably will start with Zika virus, which is can't go by without hearing or reading something about Zika virus nowadays. Malaria and dengue fever are others that come to my mind. There's some older ones like yellow fever, which still are causing some problems, and some lesser well-known ones. So if you're traveling and you're going to be around mosquitoes, this might be an excellent time to listen to the program. And if you want to call and ask questions or you have comments about your experiences, here are a couple of ways to get in touch with us over the next hour. Our local number, 550-8433, 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. And those listeners who listen weekly know I have to spell that out for you. I want to make sure you do it right, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, all one word, line1@alaskapublic.org. Ben, welcome back. It's great to have you return.
Thanks for having me again.
Let's do this. Let's start with just talking about mosquitoes, and then I think both of us have some interest in some historical facts, and then we'll dive into the diseases. So to understand at least somewhat about how these diseases are spread and what the options are for control, it would help to understand what we know about mosquitoes and how they might transmit illness.
Sure. Well, what we think of as mosquitoes here in Alaska can be several different things. Mosquitoes are animals that bite us and cause substantial amounts of nuisance. Now, the things that actually are not mosquitoes that bug some of us the most are these small things that we call here in Alaska no-see-ums. Very, very small, and you can know that they're around you because they cause this incredible buzzing sound in your ear before they bite you, and quite a wheel or irritation similar to what mosquitoes can cause. But those are not mosquitoes. Now, mosquitoes are the larger animals that have a proboscis, long nose, and very long sort of gangly legs that also cause that same wheel and itchy irritation when they bite. And what occurs is it's true, I think colloquial knowledge many people remember hearing and quote is that the females are the ones that bite, and that is true. So females need a blood meal to help their eggs develop, to incubate their eggs. And so female mosquitoes are the ones that cause trouble. And what occurs when they bite us is actually a sort of basically a two-stage process where they use a salivary gland material and a liquid material to inject keep blood that they are then going to suck out from coagulating. So they have natural anticoagulants in that fluid. That fluid, though, is a site of amplification of certain viruses or other infections. And so when there is a inoculating or quote-unquote lethal LD dose, a dose that is adequate to cause an infection in an organism, that material can lead to infections as sort of a byproduct of the biting process.
So they bite, they suck up the blood, they may acquire organisms from that person or animal that they've bitten, and then what happens?
Yeah, exactly. So They will ingest what is ever in the blood of the organism that they bite. So be it a primate, say in Africa, a mosquito may bite a chimpanzee or a great ape and take up any infectious particles in that ape. If it happens to be a virus that can live in the conditions that are present inside the mosquito and other extrinsic factors, temperature, et cetera, we can talk about, will allow adequate growth of these things. When the stuff concentrated, then it can be injected back into another organism, another primate, or by chance a human, and lead to human disease.
And most of these illnesses we've talked about now, like the Zika virus, yellow fever, malaria, are primarily transmitted by these mosquitoes that are infected, not person-to-person transmission.
Right. So we call this cluster of infections we're going to talk about today arboviruses. And arbo basically means arthropod or bug born, B-O-R-N-E, born, arboviruses. And it's specifically the conditions that exist only in the mosquito host that allow the infection to grow and concentrate enough to cause other infections in other people. Now, in rare occasions, many of these infections can be transmitted, for example, by blood transfusions when a large amount of blood is moved from one person to another, or by transplant of an organ, for example. But that is really the exception rather than the rule and quite an uncommon situation. The mosquito is the key to all of these infections.
So if we jump ahead a little bit and we wanted to do something to prevent the transmission of malaria or Zika virus or yellow fever or dengue, then we have some options. We have to somehow do something to control those mosquitoes, or we have to do something to prevent the spread of illness, like with drugs or vaccines, or then we can somehow prevent the bites with various mechanisms.
That's right. There's going to be some general principles we could apply to all of these infections, but then there also could be some principles that would be unique for each type of infection. And I'll give you some examples. So when I've traveled to Cambodia, East Timor, Africa, I've tried very, very hard not to be bitten by mosquitoes, under the thinking that if you're not bitten, then you can't get something that's transmitted by being bitten. I find this much harder to say than to actually do. I appear to be a magnet for certain things in life, not the ones I would like to be a magnet for, and the other things I am. And I appear to be a particularly strong magnet for mosquitoes. And I don't know if I was born that way or what. But using protective clothing, long pants, long shirts if possible, keeping ankles covered is one of the best ways to prevent being bitten. And the second way is to use a FDA-approved anti-mosquito, anti-bug repellent, low concentration of DEET, but there are other formulations that really do help to keep from getting bitten. If you sweat a lot, you got to reapply the stuff. You have to be very, very persistent about it. And sleeping under bed nets is one of the other major ways to prevent being bitten. The other major mechanism for controlling any of these infections is to control the population of mosquitoes, simply not allow them to be in such abundance in the community that they can cause illness. This is also sometimes easier said than done. And different forms of mosquitoes have slightly different life cycles and sites of replication and distances in which they can travel that will affect a little bit the targeting of this. Probably the best recent example for the United States has been dengue fever in the Big Island of Hawaii. And that is spread by Aedes mosquitoes, both aegypti and albopictus mosquitoes. And those will replicate almost anywhere. If you leave a bucket out in the rain, overnight, mosquitoes will find water in that bucket and start laying eggs in that bucket. People that have rain catchment collection tanks for their homes, and they use rainwater to cut down on other water they use, mosquitoes will lay eggs in that. A child's toy, a little car, remote control car that could collect water in the backyard, mosquitoes could lay eggs in that. So rigorous attention to removing any implements that would catch water is really critical to controlling mosquito populations. And anyone that's ever traveled in the third world or the developing world can tell you that controlling the amounts of discarded rubber tires along the side of the road or just trash or any loose containers in the community can be very, very hard. And so this is why, along with temperature conditions in much of the developing world, why controlling mosquito outbreaks can be very, very hard in those places.
So the other point that dawned on me that I want to make sure is clear is that although the vector, the mosquitoes that may transmit certain of these illnesses may exist in certain areas, that does not necessarily mean they are infected and can transmit it. So the virus, the bacteria, the mosquito that transmits dengue in, on the Big Island has been there for a long time, but suddenly dengue shows up there, in a, at least in a small group of people, primarily those who are indigenous there, is what I understand. So what's happening? We have some global warming. I'm pretty doggone convinced of that. We know that the range of these organisms are changing, but also these viruses are coming into places they haven't been before as well.
Yes, that's entirely true, and that will continue to happen, and probably more frequently as we have global travel that so speedily moves people and sometimes mosquitoes themselves around the world. But this is not a new phenomenon, because while the Aedes aegypti mosquitoes still populate the eastern seaboard of the United States all the way up towards D.C. and Boston, we do not see infections cycling through in those regions of the U.S., and there is a lot of mosquito control, so that is part of it. There's a substantial amount of use of air conditioning and screening that was certainly not used in the 1700s and 1800s. However, the reason that there were transient and continual outbreaks of yellow fever, as the best example, in the northeast of the United States and also through Louisiana and all through the eastern seaboard was specifically due to the movement of people and probably mosquitoes with them that were infected and then that would allow the local population of mosquitoes to become infected with a virus that had not been there for some period of time.
I want to come back to the history, but another thing that you said earlier, I want to double check to see if you've heard the same thing. When I was doing some research, I did find, like that you said, that there are individuals who apparently are more attractive to mosquitoes, particularly female mosquitoes who do the biting, and that it seems to be a heritable trait. And the traits that could be are related, I saw, was type O blood, being pregnant, increased body heat. And maybe I saw something about heavy breathers. What all that means, I don't know. But I seem to be someone who doesn't suffer from the bites as much as other people. And I don't think it's just bias in some way, as you describe it. And there seems to be some evidence to suggest that there are differences among us and attractiveness to mosquitoes.
Yeah. And I think actually it's probably a misperception of who's bitten more often, and probably more of a perception of who has the reaction, who has the wheal and the itching reaction to the bite, because I appear to be none of the things you listed. I'm certainly not pregnant, but I may be a heavy breather. I'm not entirely sure, but I definitely get pretty substantial wheals and itch and irritation, and I know other folks are with me, that, and I know they get bit and don't seem to have as much. And as a dramatic example, my youngest daughter gets very large local reactions to mosquito bites. If she's bitten on her face, she actually can get a massive swelling around her eye or her right face. And I had to enlist help from my friend, Dr. Jeff Demain, who's also been on the show with me one time when she woke up with her face entirely swollen shut. And I was trying to figure out what to do. And it was simply a large local reaction from a mosquito bite. So probably our perception of how much we're being bit depends on those wheals. And if you're somebody who doesn't develop a lot of itching wheals to mosquitoes, perhaps you're actually at more risk of catching something because you don't realize you're being bit. That's a potential line of thought.
All right. Let me remind listeners again, we're talking about mosquito-borne illnesses with Dr. Ben Wesley, an infectious disease expert. We're going to move on pretty quickly into some specific diseases after a little brief discussion about some historical facts of some interest relating mosquitoes and mosquito-borne illness. But if you've got questions or comments, let me give you some numbers again. Local number 550-8433. 550-8433, our toll-free number 1-888-353-5752, and our email address line1@alaskapublic.org. It doesn't take long when you start reading about mosquitoes and mosquito illnesses and particularly wars, that the history of these infections is a prominent component in the evolution or the development of the human species. Give us a couple of things that you think are kind of interesting about the history.
Well, mosquito illness has been described for millennia. Hippocrates described fevers and clinical syndromes that could be consistent with illnesses such as yellow fever, but it really took medical science a very, very long time to come to the notion that mosquitoes could ever transmit disease, probably simply due to the mistaken perception that most disease was airborne or due to evil humors rather than particles or germ theory, which really developed in the late 1800s. I think that probably the most dramatic example of a mosquito-borne infection, and one that would be hard to conceive of now, was the famous yellow fever outbreak in Philadelphia in 1793. In a matter of 3 months, until November frost set in a matter of 3 months, just under 5,000 deaths occurred in a city that was the most populous city at the time, 50,000 population of Philadelphia. So 10% of the city died in just about 3 months due to yellow fever. Now, yellow fever is a flavivirus. It's an RNA virus that mosquitoes can transmit, and it causes a very severe fever, aches, pains, viral-type syndrome. But about 15% of people, right after they appear to recover, then they suddenly come down ill with jaundice, so yellowing of the eyes and skin due to liver injury. They start bleeding. Their blood doesn't coagulate properly, so they start bleeding and vomiting black material and succumb a pretty gruesome death. And the outbreak became so severe that year that the capital of the United States was in Philadelphia those years, and George Washington and his cabinet had to move outside the city and conduct business outside of Philadelphia due to such severity of the outbreak. And to try to think now or imagine now a situation where an illness, even if it any illness of any sort, would lead to evacuation of the government from Washington, D.C., for example, and then particularly an outbreak due to a bug, a mosquito, which is so ubiquitous in our world, is really hard to contemplate, and I think a dramatic example of how severe these infections were.
Yeah, I don't think people realize that it wasn't that long ago that a huge portion of the southeast part of the United States was malaria was a huge issue. And I think even it's my understanding the CDC came into existence partly as an effort to try to work on controlling malaria in the southeast part of the United States in particular.
Yeah, it was not till the 1950s that malaria was eliminated from the United States, and it did not take long after the CDC's formation and aggressive mosquito control, really, that was able to primarily control it. There was something called the malaria control in war areas that the CDC grew from in 1946 and led to massive malaria control. And, you know, fortunately, it was understood that mosquitoes were the problem, and that was only due to substantial pioneering work, actually, of physicians in the late 1800s who read about the Philadelphia outbreak. Carlos Finlay, who was a Cuban physician in the late 1800s, 1881, had been reading historical works from that time, and it was frequently noted by the physicians writing about their patients that the most reliable attendants of the dead and dying were the mosquitoes that were particularly bad that summer and that were frequently filling the wards. And by that, he got the idea that mosquitoes could be transmitting the illness, and his work was carried on a bit later by researchers. We can talk a bit about their experiments, which are really fascinating, but that finally understood what the cycle for yellow fever was.
And I'll just make one more comment that I think it's pretty well understood that there were far more deaths related to malaria in the U.S. military in Southeast Asia during World War II than there was from combat. And I think it's also true that DDT came out of the efforts to try to understand how to control malaria in Southeast Asia during the war. We've got a caller already. It looks like it may be around dengue fever, but so let's go ahead and address that, although I definitely want to get to Zika pretty quickly. Chris, you're on line one.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
Yeah, first, well, I got some questions about subsequent how you recuperate from dengue fever, if you do completely. But first of all, let me disabuse any of your listeners of the delusion that you can't get it in a major urban environment, because I got it in Bangkok. And, you know, I was sick for about 5 weeks with the flu, general flu symptoms and, you know, the joint pain that you get from dengue. Finally, you know, it went away in about 5 weeks, but I went into a malaise that lasted for months. And then periodically, like over the subsequent two years, you know, I'd have these 24-hour bouts where it just seemed to mimic the entire process of the initial infection. And my question is, does it do like permanent damage? Like, does it affect the liver in a way? Because, you know, I never really felt quite the same after it.
Right. Okay. Good question.
Yeah. Your point about catching it in urban areas that are oftentimes felt maybe safer than rural areas is a really good point for listeners to keep mind of. Dengue fever, particularly, really is an urban phenomenon. These Aedes aegypti mosquitoes really only fly about 100 to 150 yards. So they stay right in a little area. And all sorts of folks with backyards, containers that have water, tend to breed in high concentration these mosquitoes. And then with folks infected, there's more likelihood for a mosquito to become infected. So urban outbreaks of dengue is typically the rule rather than the exception. Dengue fever is rarely fatal. Less than 1% of cases are fatal. It can cause liver injury and bleeding from a different mechanism at the time of the acute illness. But once the infection has transited the body, usually 7 to 10 days, there are no known lasting effects really or complications of that. But your story of being very fatigued and run down for several months is very classic and not uncommon. I'm less certain about any symptoms now several years later, and I think it would be unlikely that any symptoms currently would be related to dengue in the past.
There's another aspect of it, too, that for your listeners, I mean, you get it from actually a morning mosquito, right? It's like you're more prone to be hit with a certain species of it. The species have night shift and day shift.
Very good comment. So Aedes mosquitoes that transmit dengue are aggressive mosquitoes. They're the ones that chase you around and bite you right in the middle of the day, right in the light. They don't seem to matter that you notice them. They will still keep trying to bite you. So Aedes mosquitoes tend to bite during the day. Different mosquitoes, famously Anopheles mosquitoes that transmit malaria, tend to be early morning and late evening biters and tend to be a little more skittish and bite the ankles and other sort of hidden areas. They kind of sneak up on you. So it is true that different types of mosquitoes that transmit different types of infection attack or bite in a slightly different way and in different timing.
Thank you.
What about the fact, and I have not treated anybody with dengue fever. I've talked to some people that have had dengue fever, and those people who talk about it say the second attack is even worse than the first. And again, in my research, there is some evidence that there are different serotypes, so there are slightly different dengue viruses that can cause a second attack against what's usually thought of as you only get the infection one time and our immune system holds it off. There are some changes, and that the second attack can be worse than the first attack because of the way the immune system is responding to those organisms.
Yes, that's exactly right. There are four serotypes of dengue, dengue 1 through 4. And while specific serotypes don't seem to dramatically differ in their ability to cause illness, there is a feared and sort of dreaded complication of dengue fever that occurs in less about 1% of patients called dengue hemorrhagic fever, where you actually get very, very low platelet counts. Your blood, you start having bleeding, and all the fluid leaks out of the blood vessels into the subcutaneous fluids, and patients are very, very hard to manage from a fluid status, and they can die with substantial bleeding, which is a scary thought. And it appears possibly that that occurrence is more likely after one's been infected with one of the other serotypes. They differ enough that you aren't immune until you get all four. And somehow, probably the immune system does something to mediate that process, and that if you've had dengue before, your body's trying to fight the dengue virus and instead damages your own body to some degree. And in fact, this is the fear of trying to create a proper dengue virus vaccine. As you can imagine, most things, if you develop a vaccine that mostly works, you're good to go. But in this situation, if you don't get it all right and have a vaccine for all four types, you could potentially make people worse by vaccinating them and then having them get a different serotype than is contained in the vaccine. Mm-hmm. So this has led to big trouble trying to make a dengue vaccine.
And it, if you're thinking clearly, it seems to me if you've had dengue once and you're really smart and you say, oh, yeah, well, I'm immune the rest of my life, this is not one of those situations where you ought to feel like you're safe.
Absolutely not. And it would not be possible to get so many of the different infections that mosquitoes can give you that it would ever be safe to go to a mosquito area and not try to fully protect yourself. Because if you've had, you had yellow fever vaccine, you can still get dengue, you could get Japanese encephalitis, you could get one of a million things. So protecting oneself from biting mosquitoes in areas where they transmit infections is really pretty critical.
All right. We're already halfway through this program. I hate to say it, but let me remind listeners, you're listening to Line 1, your health connection. Our local number is 550-8433. Toll free, we're at 1-888-353-5752. Our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. We're going to take a very short break and then continue our discussion of mosquito-borne illnesses, particularly we were starting off with Zika virus with Dr. Ben Wesley. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1 from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line 1 on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back. You're listening to Line 1, your health connection from Alaska Public Media in Anchorage, Alaska. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Joining us today is infectious disease expert Dr. Ben Wesley from Anchorage. And we've discussed a little bit about the biology and the ecology, perhaps, of mosquitoes. And we talked just briefly about dengue fever. And now we would like to spend some time talking about the Zika virus. And if time allows, we'll answer more questions about dengue, malaria, West Nile virus, and a funny named virus called chikungunya, which you might want to know about, particularly if you're going to the Caribbean. You can ask or email questions to us at line1@alaskapublic.org. You can call us locally at 550-8433. Our toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752. And remember, if you're listening on Alaska Public Media between 8 and 9 on Monday evenings, that's a taped recording, and we won't be able to answer your calls. All right, Dr. Wesley, tell us the Zika story as it has unfolded recently.
So late 2015, we started getting reports that an increasing number of babies were being born with small heads, a condition called microcephaly. This can lead to substantial learning difficulties, mental retardation, and other substantial problems with children. And work on trying to sort out what might be occurring turned up in Brazil that these women had had a viral infection with malaise, muscle aches, some joint pains, red eyes, and oftentimes a flat reddish rash. And so workers there worked extremely hard to try to sort out what was occurring. And finally, after doing a lot of virus and special testing called PCR testing on these patients, sorted out that what they were seeing was Zika virus, Z-I-K-A, Zika virus. And this was particularly alarming and concerning to them for a couple of reasons. Prior to 2013, there had been just a handful of reported cases in humans. The virus was first isolated in a rhesus, I believe a rhesus monkey in Africa some 40, 50 years ago, but essentially no large outbreaks in humans. 2013, there were, I believe, about 60 or 80 cases in 60% of the island of Tahiti appeared to have become infected with Zika virus by serologies that were done in follow-up over about a six-month period in the Pacific Islands, in the Society Islands of Tahiti. And it appears that actually a soccer match between a team from the Pacific Islands that was playing in Brazil probably led some fans to coming while they were viremic and infecting the Aedes aegypti mosquitoes in Brazil. And due to the density and crowding and water other issues we've talked about with mosquitoes there, a very sort of rapidly flourishing Zika virus outbreak in Brazil is occurring. The vast majority of patients get minimal or really mild symptoms. They get a fever, they get run down, maybe like they have a flu for a few days, and then they get better. So many patients didn't report it. It was a little unclear what was occurring until they sorted it out. And it was really not until case reports of that suggested an increase in microcephaly in women that had had Zika virus during the pregnancy was reported that sort of global attention and alarm has really increased.
So it was originally thought that perhaps the Zika virus, although benign to the larger group of people, that is not having lots of significant medical problems, was now related to a very serious problem called microcephaly in the offspring of mothers who are infected during their pregnancy. Where has that story gone?
It's developing rapidly and still trying to be worked out. I think initially in the medical community, there was a very large amount of skepticism because we have never seen an infection transmitted by mosquitoes that would cause birth defects in children. And there are only a few that really do. Rubella, German measles, causes substantial birth defects and microcephaly in babies born to non-immune mothers that get it during the pregnancy. CMV virus can cause bad microcephaly, very small heads in women who happen to have a primary infection during pregnancy. But none of those are arboviruses, and none of them are really spread at the rate that any arbovirus can be spread. So this was alarming, and I think the first thing is disbelief and wanting to make sure that prior to starting a bunch of alarm that this is true. However, a series that was published in New England Journal just a few weeks ago of 88 pregnant mothers who were exposed to Zika virus showed 29% of them had pretty substantial neurological abnormalities in the fetuses. And they did go back and look in Tahiti and try to sort out whether at that time there was an increased microcephaly rate. And it appeared that there were probably about 10 cases when there should have been only two that entire year. But there were not many births, and so this took them a while to sort out. That may be because several of those fetuses were aborted, whereas in Brazil, in fact, to get an abortion requires a life-threatening problem in the mother, and there's actually a court has to approve that an abortion can be done. So it may be why we're seeing, you know, dramatic births now there versus in the Pacific Islands. But so the current thinking by the WHO and the CDC just over the last 4 to 6 weeks is that indeed it really does appear that this virus is likely the cause of these neurological abnormalities.
As a consequence of that, the CDC now has some recommendations for women traveling to certain areas to avoid getting pregnant. And I think we should really highlight that recommendation for listeners.
Yeah, I think we should. And they are relatively dramatic recommendations. And mm-hmm. as I was reading through them, I've for the last several months now, I've wanted to be sure that I'm re-reviewing them and reading them carefully. But they're pretty clear that right now, due to the amount of virus circulating and the difficulty protecting one from mosquitoes, that if you are pregnant and planning to travel, that the CDC site for which countries are involved should be reviewed, and that if a country is having substantial Zika circulating, deferring non-essential travel would be the recommendation. They also specifically are actually addressing recommendations for folks living in those countries. So if you're an expat or living in a country where Zika is circulating, and the general recommendation is essentially to defer conceiving until the Zika virus outbreak has been controlled because of this, what appears to be a pretty high risk. And then finally, they have specific recommendations for what to do after returning from travel, because several cases now have been reported of sexual transmission from one partner to another, and that also could have substantial implications for having children.
So these are really dramatic recommendations from my standpoint, from a physician standpoint, and I think it suggests strongly that there is a large amount of concern as well as a reasonable amount of uncertainty about how much this is going to be an issue. But the safe answer is to begin to warn people that their behaviors should be carefully controlled because of the unknown factors and the potential for significant problems here.
It is. And the fact that the virus does not cause severe illness in adults is really reassuring. This means if one wants to do some travel to an area that's affected and they're not currently pregnant or mm-hmm. planning to conceive, that the risk is actually mm-hmm. quite minimal. But that upon return from an area, waiting at least 8 weeks to try to conceive is the current recommendation. The incubation period is short. It's only 3 to 7 days, but illness is mild. So in an abundance of caution, they're saying 8 weeks, or forbid, one has an infection while traveling or shortly after returning. Waiting 8 weeks after the infection should make it very safe to conceive. The flip side being that if it's the male partner who does become infected, we do not yet know for sure how long virus is present in semen and could be transmitted to a sexual partner. So for men who become ill with Zika virus, they are recommending waiting 6 months to try to father a child. And all this is going to be altered, probably adjusted week to week as new information and new studies are available to guide us. But as severe as the issues can be, has led to pretty dramatic recommendations.
What is the zone of worry for exposure to Zika virus? What are we talking about? What part of the world?
Yeah. Primarily, this is the Caribbean, Central America, including Mexico, Puerto Rico, and some of South America on the east side of South America, including Brazil. And CDC website, cdc.com/Zika, will be updating this on a daily basis. And it's such a fluid situation that I would urge people to look at that site before making any specific plans and check it regularly prior to the travel.
So the site that you want to write down if you are childbearing age, you're thinking about travel to a large portion of the world where there's a lot of people, is cdc.gov/Zika, Z-I-K-A. That will be updated regularly. And in fact, you take that same website and just put the virus you're talking about that we're talking about, or malaria, and you can get some updated information for all of these viruses. So cdc.gov. /Zika for the Zika virus, /Dengue for dengue fever, /Malaria for malaria, to get updated information on this problem. So let me summarize again, because I think this is extremely important and it's developing and can be significant. I don't know that I don't feel like we've said enough that severe microcephalic infants are never going to be self-sufficient. They will require constant supervision and control of all their bodily organs. They are not going to be developing well. It's a serious, serious problem. So contraception, if you have to go into these areas, should be really of some concern if you are in the process of being in the age group and in the area where you may get these infections until we know more. So I guess what I'm saying is it looks like this Zika virus does cross the placenta, does cause neurologic damage, which is unique to these group of viruses. How often, how much is not clear, because once a woman is infected, it may take months before they deliver, and it may be so uncommon that it may take millions of infections to begin to see, or hundreds of thousands of infections to see, that there really is an increased incidence. So it's going to take us a little while to clarify how much of a concern it is. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I think so, although the data looks compelling, and that's exactly why I think people were surprised, is that for the proportion of women who could be shown to be infected, it did seem like about 20 times increased rate, which mm-hmm. is pretty substantial.
All right. We're going to move along because we do have a couple of questions. Let me take Tran. You're on line one. What can we do for you?
Hi. Yeah, I've traveled in Indonesia, in China, in the East a lot, not in Africa so much. I spent 3 months or so in Indonesia when I was a kid. I just slapped mosquito dope on myself and called it good most of the time. I started taking malaria pills, but I didn't have a problem. I have a friend who was in the Peace Corps and should have been backed up by the whole U.S. government in northeast Zambia, I think. And, you know, malaria medicine, sleeping under a net every night, et cetera, and still got malaria. So I'm wondering about extreme measures you can take if you're traveling to countries where infection is not just likely but almost assured.
Yep, good question.
So sometimes bad things happen to good people. So despite all attempts at avoiding mosquito bites, sleeping under nets, taking religiously anti-malarial medications, one still can get malaria. Usually they have an abrogated or attenuated illness, so they're not quite as ill. On occasion, the prophylactic medication they might be taking maybe is not effective. For example, there are areas of the Thai-Cambodia border where there's a substantial amount of drug-resistant malaria. So even if you were on a good prophylactic medication, one could still get ill due to that. Some medications may be slightly more effective than others. Malarone, which has a combination of etoboquone and proguanil, which works quite nicely and is pretty non-toxic, is many of our sort of prophylactic drug of choice. But that can still happen. The most common reason to get malaria in a malaria-infected area in travelers is having difficulty remembering or being able to take that medication on schedule every single day. And it really is important. And then many of them require taking the medication for a lengthy period after coming home as well. And that can be hard to do. So that's the most common reason to get it. But the longer you spend in an area with a lot of malaria, despite all best intentions, it's still possible to get malaria. There's nothing that you can do to absolutely, absolutely rule it out.
Got it. Okay. Well, that's comforting.
All right. Thanks for your call, Tran.
Thanks.
Sue, you're on line one. Let's go ahead and take Alex. Alex, you're on line one.
Hi.
What can we do for you? Yeah, what can we do for you?
I have a question that actually goes back to my childhood, and it's a little bit off topic of the Zika issue that you're talking about. But when I was 12, I'm 41 now. I got infected with equine encephalitis. by a mosquito, is what I was told. I guess going back to your previous caller, who I guess what my question is can you become reinfected with that virus, like you were saying you could with some of the malaria viruses? Not that I'm going to be in here in Alaska and everything, but and then also, are there any prolonged long-term effects that could have stayed with me over the years from that virus?
A good question. So I think you're referring to Eastern equine encephalitis, probably, although there are several different forms of equine viruses. And if you were on the East Coast, it would probably have been Eastern equine encephalitis.
It was East Coast. So it was actually Indiana.
Okay. So I can't entirely say for sure. I think it may be Eastern equine encephalitis. There are also others called St. Louis, La Crosse. There are some different ones. But so the main lasting effects can be that patients that get Eastern equine encephalitis typically have a very severe infection of the brain and the lining of the brain, and mortality is high. So patients that survive, some of them have lasting neurological complications and may have some damage to the brain and brain function. That would be the primary lasting type of effect. One would not expect lasting effects of ongoing infectious symptoms like fevers or sweats or anything like that, nor other organ damage particularly. This would all be related to brain or spinal cord pathology if that were to occur. Now, many patients can still fully recover, but that if it is triple E's, sometimes referred to as triple E, Eastern equine encephalitis, can cause more lasting damage.
As far as the brain, and because they actually tested me and with the EKGs and all that, and they concluded that there was no brain damage because I had I had a fever of like 105 for a couple days, a few days I believe. And then how about contracting it again? Just curious, is it possible?
I'm actually not familiar with, for sure, the literature on that, but the general concept would be that would be the type of infection one would expect once you get it, you would not get it again.
Okay.
Yep.
All right. Well, interesting. Thank you very much.
The idea that you can't catch it again is also true about Zika virus, as I understand. Are there other serotypes of that one as well?
It's thought to be true. That is what our current understanding is, and that is a hopeful concept because that suggests it should be relatively possible to make a vaccine then that would protect people.
A caller who'd called in earlier had some question about dengue vaccine. People who are spending some time reading about dengue or may be aware of dengue probably realize that we're a little bit further along with the dengue virus vaccine. You want to talk about that?
I haven't reviewed actually recently dengue virus vaccine current efficacy, so it's a complex topic that I would have to review. The main thing being that immunology is extremely tricky for the reasons we mentioned earlier about the four serotypes and this pretty strong concern that a strong immune system could actually cause harm rather than benefit unless you're fully protected.
Yeah, and I don't want to speak out either. I'm not an expert by any means. I think the Mexicans have a vaccine. I'm not sure it's been vetted enough. It's like Dr. Wesley saying, we may have to be very careful for the reasons we've explained
earlier. There are a lot of ongoing work and trials, much of it through the military system as well, which has been a huge historical sort of proponent of treating and protecting soldiers against arboviruses because of the areas where fighting can take place. So our country and as a whole world is heavily vested in it. There are approximately 100 million cases of dengue fever every year, 500,000 of dengue hemorrhagic fever, and 22,000 deaths a year. It's a really, really high-level attempts to create a vaccine for that disease.
One more time, I'm going to give our phone number, 550-8433, 550-8433, email address, line1@alaskapublic.org, our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. We're in our last 7 or 8 minutes, so if you've got some questions, I'd encourage you to hurry up. However, we all live in Alaska, and there's no one who lives in Alaska doesn't know that we have mosquitoes. I was introduced to Alaska with the question is, did I bring my shotgun? And I said, no. And they said, well, you know, that's the only way you're going to protect yourself from the mosquitoes. What about these mosquito-borne illnesses and the risk to Alaskans who decide they want to stay in Alaska?
So there are some bad news and good news about mosquitoes in Alaska, right? The bad news is that they can be very, very dense and swarming and miserable and misery-inducing. The good news is that we do not have the specific species of Aedes mosquitoes, aegypti and albopictus, that transmit the majority of the viral infections that we've been talking about today. There are also here Aedes species, but different species that don't tend to transmit these infections. We also have some Culex species that are slightly different than the specific Culex species that transmits West Nile virus and Japanese encephalitis, for example. So West Nile virus has been a big problem in the lower 48, but we do not have those species here in Alaska that transmit those viruses. In addition, mosquitoes, you know, are the same temperature as our ambient air. So when one is trying to work, for example, in a lab growing virus in culture, we don't do it at 40 or 50 degrees Fahrenheit. We do it at warmer temperatures because that really accelerates the viral replication. And our temperatures are too low to allow viral replication, typically under something under 70 to 77 degrees Fahrenheit is required for virus to grow in mosquitoes. And so with temperatures at night lower than that, even all through the summer, it is unlikely that our mosquitoes are going to be able to grow virus within them and concentrate the virus. Once a mosquito bites somebody, it takes about 10 days at tropical temperatures or warm lower Fahrenheit, lower 48 temperatures to grow the virus, 10 days or so to concentrate it enough in the salivary glands that they can infect somebody. And so at our temperatures, it's unlikely that's going to happen. The final thing protecting us from West Nile virus, which is really interesting, the only states that haven't had any local transmission of West Nile virus are Hawaii and Alaska. West Nile virus is specifically different than the ones we've been talking about because there's an animal host, birds, primarily jays, but it could be crows. Magpies here could potentially be a host. But humans don't have enough virus in their blood for a mosquito to pick up the virus and then concentrate it. There has to be a bird intermediary. And the birds do get sick. And in addition, they're only viremic. They only have virus in their blood for about 2 days. So a bird would have to fly all the way from the lower 48 to an Alaska region in 2 days and then transmit to a mosquito before it got sick and died. And that's a really long way to go. So we have geography and a bird intermediary sort of in our pocket as protection against West Nile virus outbreak in Alaska.
For now.
For now. I mean, so somebody could move a bird. The bird could end up on a transport ship or something and survive, you know, in a transport ship hold or, you know, et cetera. And there is surveillance. So the state is doing surveillance in Southeast, which is where the first place we would see this in mosquitoes would be mm-hmm. in mosquito sampling that's being done right. in the Southeast, because that's like the migration routes for birds mm-hmm. would come. We're also fortunate because arboviruses are such a big problem for military institutions that JBAR does surveillance in the spring at Fort Rich every mm-hmm. spring, and they do sample mosquitoes. At least I know they do it most springs. I don't know if they do it every spring, but they've been doing this for years, sampling mosquitoes right in the early hatch season in late May, and they have not shown any arboviral pathogens for many, many years in our sampling here in South Central. So we have some helpful surveillance from the federal government for us, too.
Chikungunya virus is a funny name, but if you read the newspapers or if you're a physician, you probably heard that. Particularly, I think of it as the Caribbean is another particular problem with the arbo. I think it's also a flavovirus.
Chikungunya is an alpha virus with a subspecies, Toga virus, but it's the same mosquitoes. It's the same darn Aedes aegypti and Albopictus mosquitoes. And there's actually a large amount of it in American Samoa right now. There also, though, what's getting the news is attention because this is a virus that was introduced to the Aedes mosquitoes in Florida via Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands. And so there were 12 endemically locally transmitted cases in Florida in 2014. There were about almost 3,000 cases in the territories, the U.S. territories there in 2014. But there were only 679 cases in 2015 and none in Florida. But about a year ago, this was a big concern in Florida and the southeast of the U.S. Now, we have a lot, here in Alaska, we have quite a few patients who travel back and forth from American Samoa. And so the case that I did see some months ago in the emergency department was a very florid, classic, severe case of an itchy red rash and severe peripheral joint pains in the hands and feet. And it was just a classic chikungunya virus, and we were able to confirm that case. So based on the geography of travel to and from Alaska, we are seeing imported cases from the Pacific Island region.
All right, so I was wrong in that the Caribbean does have some problems. Southeast part of the United States is at risk. The global warming is increasing the potential for the spread of these things in the southeast, I think, in Texas, maybe in Arizona as well. All right, final comments. We're in our almost last minute. Let's put some perspective on these problems, all of these mosquito-borne illnesses.
Well, one thing we do know is that this is going to be ever-changing. So a year ago, I don't know that I'd heard of Zika, or if I had, it was a board question and that was it. And now we have a major sort of public media attention to Zika virus, rightly so, because it's a bit frightening and we need to follow the science on that. Humans are never going to escape bugs and never going to be immune to infections that we could potentially get from the environment and from organisms around us. The mosquitoes are also critical, though, too. They are heavy pollinators. The male mosquitoes pollinate a large amount of crops throughout the United States, so eliminating all mosquitoes would not be good. They're important food for bats and other species. We live in an equilibrium with these organisms, but we need to continually be vigilant, monitor, try to keep from being bitten ourselves, and then support organizations such as Gates Foundation and others who are really supporting work to help developing countries control their infections and mosquito populations, because we are all in this together. We are a net of countries and people and places that all intertwine. Everyone travels, air travel, something around the world could be here in 24, 48 hours. And we all need to support each other to making the world a better place.
Ben, thank you very much. We covered a lot of information. It was well done, I think. I appreciate your time. My thanks to Anchorage infectious disease specialist Dr. Ben Wesley for his time today. You can continue this discussion on mosquito-borne illness by joining KSKA on Facebook. You can find that link at www.alaskapublic.org. You can also find our Line 1 archives at that same address. Next week, Line 1, your health connection, is going to talk about human behavior and how it affects health, and a look at the Matsu Health Foundation's efforts to really understand behavior and health in the Matanuska Valley. So join us next Monday at 2 p.m. Pat Yak is the chief content officer here. Eric Bork is our web editor, and Dave Waldron was our audio engineer. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life informed. This is Alaska Public Media.